Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 4th, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear a telephone on the False Claims Act and if it is time for a change. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Marcia G. Madsen, who is a partner at Mayer Brown, and Brian D. Miller, a shareholder at Rogers Joseph O'Donnell. I will turn it over to Marcia to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Marcia. The floor is yours.
Good afternoon, everyone. Brian and I are pretty excited, actually, to have this discussion. We both participate with the administrative law executive group, and we think this is a topic that maybe doesn't get enough attention, so we want to talk about it. So we're going to talk about the False Claims Act, implied certification, and how the False Claims Act is a tool to enforce particular statutory, regulatory, or contract or grant terms by the government and by relators who frequently are, of course, joined together in their views. So there's administrative law issues here that I think we both believe, and Brian can speak for himself, are sometimes not recognized because they arise in the context of an asserted false claim, but they're really issues about interpreting statutes, regulations, and terms of various types of agreements with the government. So under the False Claims Act, which is a civil statute, the Civil False Claims Act, a claim may be factually false or impliedly false. Under the implied certification theory, a party making a request for payment to the government is impliedly certifying that it has complied with relevant statutory, regulatory, or contractual provisions just by making the request. This theory has been controversial. It's been litigated through the circuits, and it finally led to the Supreme Court resolving it last year in Universal Health versus Escobar. In Escobar, the court unanimously held that the implied certification theory, quote unquote, can be a claim for liability, or can be a basis, I'm sorry, for liability under the FCA. So they validated unanimously the existence of the implied certification theory as a basis for liability. But the court said at least where two conditions are met. The first one is the claim does not merely request payment, but also makes specific representations about the goods or services provided. And second, that the defendant's failure to disclose noncompliance with material statutory, regulatory, or contractual requirements makes those representations misleading half-truths. The court also stated that any concerns about fair notice and open-ended liability raised by the defendant and other critics of false certification can be effectively addressed through strict enforcement of the Act's materiality and scienter requirements. So focusing on, I think, the potential open-endedness of implied certification, the court emphasized that the materiality standard is, quote, demanding and, quote, rigorous and must be pleaded with particularity. Okay, here we go. Particularity. Still got it wrong. For a party attempting to comply with numerous statutory, regulatory, and contractual or terms of other agreements, for that matter, in today's heavily regulated government and business environment, what does implied certification mean? And I think despite the Supreme Court's opinion, the short answer is still not clear. So just think for a minute about all of the federal programs where grants or loans or loan guarantees are made, where fees are collected, contracts are awarded, infrastructure money is provided to states and transit districts, healthcare funding is provided, and the mountain of regulations and terms that go with these programs. Now, Brian and I both work in the government contracts area, so we start with statutes, and then we have 18 volumes of the federal acquisition regulation, and then we have contracts that are frequently, 1,000 pages long. But those aren't the only areas of concern. There are a lot of regulatory programs out there. So the Supreme Court, obviously, I think with this in mind, said that the False Claims Act was not an all-purpose fraud statute or a vehicle for punishing garden variety breaches of contract or regulatory violations. Great, sounds good, but the court then did not provide a clear test for materiality, and it's materiality that we're going to talk about today. The court noted that under both the False Claims Act statutory, quote, natural tendency to influence, end quote, standard, and the common law, that materiality looks to the effect on the likely or actual behavior of the recipient of the alleged misrepresentation. In other words, what did the government think, you know, when it got the alleged misrepresentation? The court emphasized that proof or refutation of materiality must be based on the conduct of the parties, which is a fact-based inquiry. The court accordingly noted that the government's decision to expressly identify a provision of law, regulation, or a term of a contract or agreement as a condition of payment is relevant but not automatically dispositive. So where does that leave us? The court then emphasized that the subjective intentions of both the government and the defendant are important considerations, but the examples that the court provided all focused on the conduct or pattern of conduct of the government. So we should talk about these for a minute because that's where the guidance that we have from the court comes from. So according to the court, proof of materiality can include but is not necessarily limited to evidence that the defendant knows that the government consistently refused to pay claims in the mine run of ordinary cases, I love that phrase, based on noncompliance with particular statutory, regulatory, or contractual requirements. Okay, so it's not limited to the fact that the defendant knows the government consistently refused to pay claims in ordinary cases based on noncompliance with particular requirements. The court then said, conversely, if the government pays a particular claim, a specific one, in full, despite its actual knowledge that certain requirements were violated, that's, quote, very strong, close quote, evidence that those requirements are not material. Or if the government regularly pays a particular type of claim, so not just a particular claim, but a particular category of claim in full, despite its actual knowledge that certain requirements were violated and has signaled no change in position, that is strong evidence that the requirements are not material. So the guidance that the court gave us is knowledge on the part of the defendant that the government has refused to pay claims in a set of ordinary cases based on noncompliance with requirements, or conversely, if the government either pays a particular claim despite its knowledge or regularly pays a type of claim and hasn't changed its position. There's your parameters for what materiality is. So why do these standards matter, such as they are? And they matter because individuals and companies have to guess at how these standards are going to be applied for determining what a false claim is and isn't material. Almost all the cases so far are in the motion to, so the cases post-Escobar are in the motion to dismiss or summary judgment stage, except the remanded cases that were pending at the time of Escobar, such as the Triple Canopy case in the Fourth Circuit, which we're all waiting to see what happens because it's been argued. But there's a lot of pushing and shoving to see whether defendants can get rid of a case at the motion to dismiss stage or whether they have to go to discovery to determine materiality and use summary judgment. But there aren't really that many decisions yet. So coming back to Escobar, the Supreme Court in Escobar rejected the First Circuit's view that had been argued by the Department of Justice repeatedly prior to Escobar, that noncompliance is material if the government could lawfully have denied payment. In other words, had the option to lawfully deny payment. The fight today is over whether the United States or a relator must prove that the government would have denied payment. In other words, an objective test. Post Escobar, the Department of Justice has filed multiple statements of interest in cases around the country where DOJ argues that materiality must be determined by, and I'm going to quote this, quote, a holistic assessment of the tendency or capacity of the undisclosed violation to affect a government decision maker, end quote. So I've always wondered what holistic meant, but I guess we're going to find out. Anyway, in its statement of interest, in the remand to the Fourth Circuit on the Triple Canopy case, the Department of Justice stated this holistic position, and then it made, I think, the remarkable statement that the court did not, the Supreme Court did not impose a new requirement, contrary to both the FCA and common law, that the United States or a relator must demonstrate that the government would actually refuse payment. There are some lower courts supporting or trending toward this view. For example, in the remand of Escobar, the First Circuit didn't weigh in on could versus would, but it did emphasize that the materiality test was holistic. So probably no bright line test, at least in the First Circuit. There are two post-Escobar cases in California that we're going to talk about a little bit. Brian's going to talk more about them, but one in the Central District and one in the Northern District, where the district courts both excused the fact that the government continued to pay after discovering wrongdoing by raising what were essentially hypothetical reasons, things that might occur, such as public safety. So one of the cases is Brown versus Celgene last year, where the Central District of California pointed out that just because the government may continue to pay after discovering wrongdoing doesn't establish lack of materiality because the government might wish to avoid further costs or afford the accused party the opportunity to be heard. And the court went on to say payment of claims after learning of potential fraud doesn't necessarily undermine a materiality finding because perhaps important public health or safety considerations may warrant the government's continued payment of claims. In Rose v. Stevens Institute, which I know Brian's going to talk about, the district court in the Northern District of California determined that the Department of Education's decision not to take action against the defendant, despite awareness of the allegations in the case, is not terribly relevant to materiality. And then the court didn't explain why that was, except to say there wasn't any basis for the court to infer that the Department of Education had actual knowledge of the violations or considered them unimportant. There is a decision in the Ninth Circuit on a case that was pending at the time that both Rose and Celgene were decided. And in the Rose case, the district court judge has certified that for interlocutory appeal. But at the same time, there was a case pending in the Ninth Circuit that was decided earlier this year, Kelly v. Serco. It's just not clear what precedential value that case has, but it's a good example of an interpretive issue. So in a sort of highly simplified version here, Serco was required under its government contract to account for its progress in a certain manner using an earned value management system, which is required for most DOD contracts of a certain size. And Serco tried to do that, but found their accounting system wasn't automated in such a way that they could do it. So they didn't do it. They did it by hand, manually. And Serco advised the government agency, the DOD agency, that it could not follow the EVMS requirement, and they told them what they were doing. The agency actually said, fine. They later deleted the requirement. But the relator then tried, who had been actually fired by Serco when they didn't need him anymore, tried to make an argument that the EVMS requirement was regulatory, couldn't be changed. And to decide this case, to which I want to be clear here, the relevant agency had already decided they didn't care about this requirement and deleted it from the contract. But to decide this case, it had to go to the Ninth Circuit, which found that noncompliance with the EVMS was not material, that the dispute was over the format used to report costs, and, of course, finally noted that the buying agency was on board with Serco's approach. But it had to go to the Ninth Circuit to be resolved. there are some interesting cases in other interesting cases in D.C., and I want to get to Brian because I've used up most of my time, but I just want to point out one case, which is the Toyobo case. I think that's how it's pronounced, the body armor case, that was decided in 2015 by Judge Roberts in the district court. The government, in its second motion for reconsideration this year, brought the complaint back, and Judge Friedman looked at it. And basically, the government's position was, now that we've got Escobar, all of the issues that Judge Roberts dealt with are up for reconsideration. Judge Roberts had denied or granted summary judgment on 4, partial summary judgment, and denied it on 2, sending 2 issues to trial. And DOJ argued in its second request for reconsideration that Escobar had changed the law, that the partial summary judgment was incorrect, and that all 6 claims should go to trial. So Judge Friedman went back this year and looked at what did Escobar say, and determined that, at least in the D.C. circuit, that Escobar expanded the basis for False Claims Act liability to include an examination of whether there was liability for material misrepresentations as contractual, statutory, and regulatory requirements. And Judge Roberts had earlier just focused his attention on contractual requirements. Judge Friedman also noted the Supreme Court's admonition about rigorous application and materiality in Scienter. But he went on to analyze each of these specific contractual requirements, did an exhaustive review of them, and guess what? Came out in the same place that Judge Roberts came out. So again, we have the court having to review very specific contractual and provision requirements in order to reach a determination on materiality. So I think the key point that I'd like to put out here and hopefully have some discussion on following Brian's presentation is, if a requirement in a statute, regulation, or contract is not clear or is subject to more than one reasonable interpretation, can the defendant's failure to comply result in a misleading half-truth that's material? Brian, it's all yours.
Thank you, Marcia, and thanks for setting me up with such an easy question. But it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me to speak. These webinars are always challenging because you don't have an audience to look at, and so we're not sure, you know, just how you're following and how much you know about the False Claims Act and the implied certification theory and the Escobar case. But the way I boil down Escobar, just to make it real easy for everyone, is that, you know, especially for clients, how do you know when the implied certification theory applies? It's a riddle. The answer is when a federal judge says it does. And the two main factors the federal judge will use to justify his or her decision will be materiality and intent. I don't know if that's fair or not, but that's an easy, straightforward answer. And what it means for our potential clients is they have to hire a lawyer because they may end up going to court because they don't really know when it will apply and when it will not. And there are a lot of cases out there that interpret Escobar in different ways, as Marcia went through. And so, and you have the Department of Justice interpreting Escobar in a narrow way, saying it doesn't affect the statutory definition of materiality, which is quite broad, which is anything having a natural tendency to be capable of influencing the payment or receipt of money or property. That can be quite broad, and the judges, even after Escobar, are going both ways on materiality. But that is the key issue, a key issue. The other key issue would be intent. But just to step back for a minute for an even bigger picture, you know, I was a former fraud prosecutor, a former AUSA, and There are three parts of a fraud prosecutor's mind. It's lying, cheating, and stealing. And so you don't, you know, here, I think that lying, there's the problem is providers are not lying. They're not saying anything false. So lying is out the window. We're talking about cheating. And just to illustrate that, the way I first became familiar with implied certification was when I was in AUSA, and I had done kickback cases, medical kickback cases, and I thought they were hard and frustrating. You know, I realized there are statutes that have been passed since then, but we're talking about ages ago. So I had to go through, comb through hospital cost reports and figure out if they've been reconciled or not reconciled to find the actual money that was the kickback to the doctor for referring patients. And then I could trace that through and say that is a false claim because they're lying that this is some administrative fee when in reality it's a kickback. But if you look at it, you have a patient that needs a heart surgery. The hospital provided the heart surgery. The federal government paid for it. They would have paid for it at any hospital. So how is the government harmed in that? There's no loss to the government. There's no lying about it. The hospital did the surgery. And so that's the basic kind of frustration or issue when you come to implied certification. Now, there have been laws passed since then making it illegal to give kickbacks and remuneration of all sorts and saying that will be a false claim
in the healthcare
area. Now, so that's clarified the whole issue. But now, just take a different example other than kickbacks. Let's say a provider, a defense contractor, submits a claim for payment. And perhaps they didn't follow everything in the FAR to the T, or perhaps they didn't comply with the contract precisely. When they submit that claim, is that claim a certification that they followed the contract and the regulations perfectly? And, you know, if not, is that submitting the claim false? And so the, you know, and it's been worked on. So it's now whether when they submit the claim, whether they follow the contract and the regulation substantially or is there a breach, a material breach? And that's where we get materiality from. And also, did they do it intentionally? But that's where those two elements come from. And the Supreme Court in Escobar, as Marcia said, made it a little bit easier because she went through the two-prong test. And the two-prong test was, Justice Thomas said, you have to have a specific representation. And then, secondly, that the facts have to be such that that specific representation does not amount to a half-truth. And so there's two parts to that test. Well, not every court after that has followed that two-prong test. And the most notable example is the case in Northern California. Judge Hamilton in Rose versus Stevens Institute said, you know what, that two-prong test, it's not mandatory, it's optional. Because, you know, and you look at the wording, and the wording said, Justice Thomas does say, at least, you know, to find implied certification, you must, you know, have this two-prong test, but the language is not tight enough to say that you have to have it in every situation. There may be a universe of cases where implied certification applies that don't have the two-prong test. And unfortunately, in writing the opinion, Justice Thomas did say that he wasn't looking at every case. He was simply looking at the facts before him. And in the facts before him, you needed the two-prong test. And so Judge Hamilton didn't apply it. And you might think, well, maybe it's an obvious case where it's an obvious fraud. Well, it's not exactly an obvious fraud. It's a case against an educational institution, And the allegation is that the educational institution was paying commissions to people to recruit students, which is against the rules. It's against the, there is actually a statute as well, but it's in the provider participation agreement that every recipient of federal grant, education grants and loans receives. And the provider participation agreement is quite thick. It has lots of rules and regulations. But in the Rose case, the specific issue was this incentive compensation. And colleges and universities have marketing people, and so they pay salaries. And so a lot of the times the issue is whether the salary is in some way connected to how many students were brought in to the university or college or institute that year. And so the plaintiff or the relator in that case brought suit. Judge Hamilton, first of all, said the implied certification theory applies. We're not following the two-prong test. And then for materiality, Judge Rose went on to say that that nothing in Escobar suggests that actions short of complete revocation of funds are irrelevant to the court's materiality analysis. Here, the government's corrective reforms, fines, settlement agreements show that it considered the incentive compensation bar to be an important part of the Title IV bargain and that it took action against schools based on the incentive compensation ban noncompliance. These actions show that the incentive compensation ban noncompliance was, quote, capable of influencing, end of quote, and this quote from the False Claims Act, of influencing the government's payment decisions. And she went on to deny summary judgment on the part of the defendant. And so under Judge Hamilton's view, there was a triable issue of fact, even though part of the evidence, part of what was presented was a very inconsistent and spotty record on the Department of Education side of enforcing this ban. In fact, they were not enforcing it until an inspector general issued a report saying, hey, you're not enforcing this. And then they started to enforce it and to send out a letter, and then they fell off enforcing it again. It was very inconsistent. But it was enough for Judge Hamilton to say, well, it could have, you know, the ban could have influenced, it was capable of influencing the decision for payment. And so she denied the defendant's motion for summary judgment. So that's one court's determination. It's on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. The Seventh Circuit has taken a different approach. There was a case in that came up along with Escobar, and it was the case of U.S. Ex Rel Nelson versus Sanford Brown. Sanford Brown owns a number of colleges in the Midwest, and it came up on appeal from the district judge who granted summary judgment for the defendants. And that was a case where a former employee of Sanford Brown brought suit as a relator, alleging numerous violations of the provider participation agreement, including the incentive ban, incentive compensation ban, but also things such as whether or not students were appropriately put on probation. They had to maintain a certain grade average and various other violations of this provider participation agreement. Judge Mannion for the Seventh Circuit affirmed the district court's grant of summary judgment. And he said, look, the false, and I'm going to quote, the False Claims Act was not designed for use as a blunt instrument to enforce compliance with all regulations. rather, under the False Claims Act, evidence that an entity has violated conditions of participation after good faith entry into its agreement with the agency is for the agency, not the court, to evaluate and adjudicate. And so he rejected the relator's claims and affirmed the grant of summary judgment. Of course, after Escobar, that opinion had to be reevaluated, and Judge Mannion, surprisingly, actually not surprisingly, reached the same conclusion. And he simply said, here, Nelson, the relator, has offered no evidence that the government's decision to pay would likely or actually have been different had it known of the alleged noncompliance with the regulations. At bottom, even assuming Nelson's allegation are true, the most he has shown is that Brown's supposed noncompliance and misrepresentations would have entitled the government to decline payment. In other words, it's an agency issue. It's not a federal court issue. These are regulations and regulatory requirements and administrative requirements. And in other words, it's not a federal case. Now, that's a panel of the Seventh Circuit. The Rose case, that Rose versus Stevens Institute, is on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. So you may have a Ninth Circuit panel that may take the same position as Judge Hamilton, that Escobar should be construed narrowly, as DOJ has been urging, where you don't have to apply the two-prong test to get to the implied certification theory, and that materiality is extremely broad, and that is, under the definition under the False Claims Act, having a natural tendency to be capable of influencing the payment or receipt of property or money. Marcia, do you want to add anything? Or?
Brian, we should talk about Triple Canopy.
Okay.
Sure. Triple Canopy is another defense contractor case that involved the interpretation of the contract. It was on appeal at the same time as Escobar, and it was remanded to the Fourth Circuit. It presents another interesting question about sort of whose decision is it, right? Is it the agency's decision, or what does the contract mean? In that case, there's a contract overseas for guard services that Triple Canopy filled by using, as I recall, guards from Uganda. And the contract had approximately 20 requirements in it. They had to, you know, use the mirror under the car, keep control of the gates, various things, and one of them was marksmanship, which they were supposed to be trained on. The contractor is alleged to have falsified the marksmanship records and placed them in the file, where they were never reviewed by the relevant contracting official. But there was a relator claim. So the case has been filed on the basis of implied certification and went up to the Supreme Court where it was sitting. And you might recall a reference in the oral argument to guards who can't shoot straight. It may have been to that case. There's another case that could have been a reference to. But that case was sent back to the Fourth Circuit. It's been argued. And I think people are watching it with a lot of interest because we have on the one hand an agency that was apparently satisfied with the work that was performed, wasn't stressed over the marksmanship requirement. We have, it on the other hand, a contractor who seemed to feel a need to put things in the file that might someday be reviewed that were not accurate. So we'll see which given the way the Ninth Circuit might go, given the way other circuits might go, which way the Fourth Circuit lands, but that's probably the next one up.
Judge Shedd on the Fourth Circuit made a big deal about the alleged false record that the, as I recall, the relator actually was forced to write it.
Was involved with it.
Was involved with it, yes. And And so Judge Shedd said, look, if you're looking for intent that they thought they were doing something wrong, they allegedly made a false record to cover it up. And that shows intent, according to Judge Shedd in the Fourth Circuit opinion that's now on appeal. But go ahead, Marcia.
I was going to say, one of the interesting things about the case, and if the counsel for the case were here, I know she would say, is, okay, but who looked at it, right? So where's the misleading half-truth, right? It may be a half-truth, but was anybody misled? It's going to be an interesting decision.
Right, yeah, no, that's a good point. But usually it's the other conduct that gets contractors in trouble as well. You know, the attempts to kind of minimize or cover and that sort of thing. And so that certainly played a key role in Judge Shedd's written opinion last year on the case, where he found that there was potentially False Claims Act liability and allowed the case to go forward. But now on remand, we'll see. We'll see if that is enough to make the specific representation a half-truth when no one looked at it and no one cared.
Brian, I've got actually a question for you, because Brian, in addition to being a former AUSA, was also the Inspector General at the General Services Administration for quite a while, actually. And if you're willing to talk about it, Brian, maybe you could provide a little insight into the kinds of requirements that people would bring to you and say, you know, this is a big problem, you know, whether those are the kinds of things that should normally be addressed in the contracting process as opposed to by an oversight or enforcement official, and maybe you could give us some kind of insights into how some of the officials at GSA were thinking about this.
Well, you know, obviously I am somewhat limited in what I could say, but, you know, as you can imagine, the False Claims Act provides kind of a super tool for anyone in a federal agency who wants to enforce a regulation, because, you know, if you rely on administrative remedies, they could be pretty mild or ineffective. But if you're all of a sudden threatening someone with a False Claims Act suit, they're facing treble damages and then civil penalties of, what, now $11,000 to $22,000 per false claim. That's a huge hammer. And so any regulator would want to wield that hammer. And so if you do have violations of a contract or violations of a regulation, no matter how specific or recondite the regulation, the False Claims Act is a nice tool to have in your toolbox. Having said that, there are, you know, cases where there are contractors that do defraud the government and do submit false claims and are properly subjected to False Claims Act cases. But, you know, there have been a number of cases in when I was Inspector General. Our office participated in a number of False Claims Act cases. And, you know, not every potential claim became part of a False Claims Act case. I do know, you know, there have been times when a contract provision was clear. The general counsel of the agency had a different interpretation of what the plain language of the contract said. Contractors followed the general counsel's interpretation of it, although he never sent out guidance or any sort of communications to the contractors to give them a clue, but they somehow knew this. So at one point, auditors had gone through and audited and determined that a particular contractor had lots of violations of this contract provision, and mainly, it could be up to like $1 million worth or maybe more, I forget, but we could just make it hypothetical to clarify that sort of thing.
that so the auditors had worked up a nice audit and could be a basis for showing the contractor, you know, violated the contract provision, submitted claims for these amounts, were paid, and the contractor should not have been paid, and make a referral to the Department of Justice. Department of Justice then would bring a False Claims Act case saying they knew what they were doing when they did this, and that they should be subject to False Claims Act liability. But when I read the plain language of the contract, I kept coming back and saying, but this is not what it says. The contractor did what the plain language of the contract said. And so, you know, I did not let that go forward. The general counsel's office actually wanted it to go forward. And so I had to write a memorandum to the general counsel and recommended that if that's what they want, they need to change the language of the contract. And that eventually they did. They it took a while, but they withdrew the clause in the contract, and I believe they now have a revised version of the language in there. But that could have been, you know, I could see that actually have that could have become part of a False Claims Act case against the contractor, and the contractor is simply following the language of the contract. And there are many times when it's simply a dispute about what the contract language means. Sometimes, and this, they end up in False Claims Act cases. Marcia and I were talking about a case out in California before the call, where a contractor, I guess it's public.
That's a public opinion.
Honeywell had a dispute with DOD over their GPS. They had enhanced GPS. And Honeywell thought that the enhancement was owned by Honeywell, and they charged the government license fee for using the enhanced GPS. And the government didn't like that, so they there is a relator, I guess someone from Honeywell that left and filed suit. And so that case went up to district court as a False Claims Act case, saying that all the claims for license fees are false claims under the False Claims Act because they submitted a false claim. In fact, it's just a contract dispute about what does the contract say about who owns the product. The district judge in the case said, no, this is a contract dispute. It's not a False Claims Act case. Then it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit agreed with the district judge and said, look, this is simply a contract dispute. It's not a False Claims Act case. Well, the question that Marcia asked me originally was, how do you know when a contract dispute is just a contract dispute to be resolved at the agency level, and when it is a dispute that is essentially a False Claims Act violation? And I guess my answer is when a federal judge says it is. It gets to be difficult because, you know, which provision of the contract is so important that submitting a claim, even though you may not be in full compliance with that provision, makes the claim false.
Right, and most of those provisions are the subject of regulation. That's why they're mandatory provisions that are in the contract. So if you've not complied, then you've not complied with both a term and a regulation.
Right, and sometimes there's a statute. For example, in the educational area, there are statutes, but not every statute has a remedy, and you know, not every statute is written as a restriction on private companies. So ultimately, you know, the authority for the contract clause, I'm not sure that's all that important, but some do have statutes and regulations behind them, some don't. But it comes down to this issue of if a contractor disagrees with the agency, you know, what does the contractor do? Does the contractor then do the work, submit the claim, and risk having a False Claims Act case brought against them? Marcia?
So we should probably open this to questions. I was just going to make one other observation that many regulatory, statutory and regulatory provisions, not only in the government contracts area but in other areas, have remedies. They have administrative remedies that are part of the either the statutory scheme or the regulatory scheme. I'm thinking immediately the Truth in Negotiations Act in our field, but there are many of them with built-in remedies. They're intended to make the government whole for probably what would be fairly characterized as disagreements or minor failures. And so the question, again, that's been bothering me is, you know, if the requirement's not clear or if it's the agency's responsibility, when does it turn into a false claim, and is this a place where the statute itself could need more guidance? And I think with that, we can open for questions. Brian, I've got more comments, but we'd like to get some questions.
Great. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Looks like we have our first question. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, Marcia. This is Chief Judge Braden of the United States Court of Federal Claims. I thought the topic of your seminar was timely, and I don't know if any other judges are on the in the audience, but I did forward the notice to the entire court and to their law clerks and hope that they would listen to the program. I would just make a anecdotal comment that we have noticed a significant increase of false claim and variety thereof of counterclaims in our regular contract cases. I might note in particular a lot of small, medium-sized contractors who may not have committed fraud, but basically, you know, either were sloppy or you know, they didn't have malice in their heart. But it's a very heavy bargaining tool from the government. It's a big stick for them to carry, and obviously they're exercising it. At least we're seeing it here. I'm hoping to get some stats on that from the court. That's one of the projects we're going to have some people do during over the summertime, because it has a real chilling effect on people, because they may say, well, I'm going to get, somebody's going to claim fraud after me. Well, I just won't bother trying to collect my money. It's not worth it to me in the business sense. And that's a tough position to be in. So that's my only comment. Thank you for taking the effort to do this, and obviously for the Federal Society to sponsor such an important program.
Thank you. Brian, did you have a comment?
Yes, Chief Judge. The Department of Justice does publish its statistics about how many False Claims Act cases are brought, in particular they make much of how much revenue they bring back to the federal treasury as a result of their False Claims Act cases, and they publish that every year. I can get you the latest statistics if you'd like.
Sure. You know how to get them to me.
I do.
Okay. But do they include our court's counterclaims?
No, I don't know the answer to that question. We'd have to check.
I don't know if they do or not, but I still want to see if we can start keeping track ourselves. Obviously, this is a huge area of interest to Senator Grassley. I noticed in the hearings for the Justice Gorsuch that he mentioned with great pride his authorship of the bill and how successful it has been in collecting revenues for the government. So, and you know, I think he's right. I mean, I think there are cases where the government needs to be very aggressive. My only concern is sometimes in the smaller areas, not small, but small and medium-sized contractors who are not giants, and maybe have a bookkeeper, you understand what I'm saying, a small operation. You know, I don't know that they're necessarily sometimes fraudulent behavior. I've seen stuff that I think is sloppy, but I guess I feel like I know fraud when I see it. So, all right, thank
you. Your Honor, I believe that would be a great idea to keep your own stats on that, and I'll get you whatever DOJ has.
Your Honor, in response to your comment, I think one of the reasons that we're kind of focused on these issues, and particularly the interpretive issue with respect to implied certification is that, and the standards is that some, and what the statistics, people are familiar with them, probably a lot of people here are, will show is the large number of these matters that are settled. You know, they're not resolved by a judge. They're settled because someone becomes convinced by perhaps a prosecutor's, I guess I call him a civil prosecutor, but a prosecutor's view of what the law means or what the requirement was. And that's not to say that there aren't violations too, but when the issue's an interpretive one and there's pushing and pulling between the parties about what it means, there's a lot of pressure on companies in particular to resolve it and move on, even though they may be fully justified in their interpretation, but they don't want to have to bother with, you know, 5 years of litigation to get it out there. So just an observation. Other questions?
Let's go to the next caller.
Yes. Hi, my name is Howard Cox, and I very much appreciate the presentation that you both made. I bet you made some really good arguments there on Escobar and its potential progeny. One question I just had for you, though, that gave me a cause for concern. You had talked at one point about triple canopy and the fact that, well, the government never reviewed the documentation that was provided by the company, so therefore the government's payment based upon a lack of review might be okay and might excuse the non-performance or the fraudulent, you know, documentation that was indeed there. And I guess part of my concern is, as you both well know, the government nowadays can't afford to audit every claim prior to payment. They can't afford to inspect every delivery prior to payment. I'm assuming you're not suggesting for a moment then that the payment process be slowed down as a condition of, so while the government to do 100% review prior to payment. We all know that that's just not the way work can be done. So if there are indeed fraudulent misrepresentations regarding performance or a violation of implied certifications, why should the government not reviewing it have a direct impact on fraud liability?
Howard, if I may, you raise some good points, and we're not advocating that the government has to audit every single claim and spend a lot of money doing that. We brought it up in the context of the two elements that are the key elements after Escobar: materiality and intent. And on the one hand, a false document intended to cover up is evidence of intent. But then on the other hand, if nobody looks at it, it may be evidence of whether it's material or not. In fact, that may be evidence that it's not material. And we were concerned about those particular points. So we were kind of down in the weeds in our comments about that.
That's very true. I think what Lisa, and I'm probably the one who started this, was trying to do was juxtapose for purposes of the materiality analysis the facts that make this particular case so interesting, given what the Supreme Court said about how materiality should be analyzed and whether it's something is a misleading half-truth and how you would determine that. So I think a lot of folks are really interested to see what the Fourth Circuit does with this case.
But if I could just follow up real quick on the materiality is defined here is the same materiality standard we've used for years in, say, for example, prosecuting violations of the False Statements Act. The statement doesn't have to affect the government's decision. It merely has to have the capability of affecting the government's decision. So if someone lies to the FBI during the context of an interview and the FBI knows that they're lying, it doesn't make it any less of a crime, but the FBI doesn't know there's a lie.
Howard, you're right about the general history behind the statutory definition of material under the False Claims Act. The statutory definition is having a natural tendency to influence or be capable of influencing the payment or receipt of money or property. The Escobar opinion has a lot of comments on that, and they specifically didn't answer some questions about materiality, but they do have indications of what the Supreme Court thinks that materiality means. So there is now an Escobar gloss on the meaning of materiality. And of course, if we're representing contractors, we like the comments that talk about it being a rigorous standard and a strict standard. But it's not as clear as you might think.
Which is what the lower courts, I think, are going to be grappling with. I don't think it's what you can tell the lower courts are grappling with, is where are we on the spectrum between the statutory definition and what the court had to say, which was they actually didn't need to decide whether the materiality requirement that they were addressing was either governed by 3729b-4 or derived from common law, because the court said any understanding of the concept of materiality, it looks to the likely or actual behavior of the recipient of the alleged misrepresentation, which is what makes this discussion interesting, is, what did the recipient do? Was it a half-truth that affected the recipient? And what is the interesting thing about that particular case? Is it a
subjective test or an objective test?
It's a subjective test, right? What's the impact on the recipient? And my only point about the Fourth Circuit case is that it's just interesting about what the recipient knew, I guess, and when they knew it and when they relied on it. That's why I think waiting to see what the decision says is a very, very interesting outcome.
Unfortunately, there's enough language in the opinion that
you can
argue kind of both sides.
Right.
Does that help, Howard?
I mean, Howard, you see DOJ arguing that. I mean, DOJ is saying, you've got to look at a holistic approach, and that the Supreme Court didn't mean to change the statute.
Right. It's objective.
And so
under DOJ.
Right. Under DOJ's view, it is, and under some of the language in the court, maybe it's a little different. We'll see. We're going to find out. It's just going to take a while.
I'll make a final call for questions. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next telephone conference call is scheduled for Tuesday, May 9th. That call will feature Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton to discuss his latest amicus brief in the Exxon investigation. Not seeing any more questions, would you both like to make some closing remarks?
Sure, very, very short. If we had a purpose today, really, it was to get folks to think about how implied certification impacts all kinds of administrative and regulatory decisions. And it also raises a question, I think, of who in an agency has to know what, right? I mean, even if the people are charged with administering a program or payments under a program know, sometimes DOJ's view has been, could the government have declined, or would the government have declined, right? Their view definitely tends toward the could, and it may not be that clear as to what the government knew and when they knew it, and then who in the government needs to know. And I think the question we kind of wanted to tee up is, does this need some more clarity, and is there room in the statute for some more clarity on this? Brian, go ahead.
Just very briefly, in terms of the Federalist Society, we talked about regulation and creeping regulation, and nobody ever thinks of the False Claims Act. And, some of these cases have quite a regulatory feel to them, and to the extent that that increases, that's something that we probably want to think about and talk about more. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everyone.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.